Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with Stephen Hayden about Pearl Jam. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, Jim and I have two new albums to review by Bjork and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs.
Are these just excuses to not connect? Our differences are irrelevant.
That is Adipose, the first track from the 10th studio album by Bjork, Fossara. Her first studio album since 2017 when she put out Utopia. Fossara means she who digs, Jim, in case you were wondering.
I wasn't, but yes.
It's sort of a made-up word, one of those Bjorkian phrases that she made up. She's an influencer, right, Jim? From Iceland,
everybody
influencers
knows Bjork, yes.
In the 20th century. Music, art, fashion, technology. People look to Bjork for tips on all of the above. She's one of those type of people who what she does is innovative almost in every aspect of her life. In the musical world, producer, singer, performer, conceptualist, she pretty much does it all.
Yeah. Let's not forget fashion icon with the swan dress.
But I'm just talking about the music stuff.
I mean,
put her in a studio and she's been in charge for a very long time. She has worked with a number of collaborators over the years. Let's not forget that, but she brings them together in innovative ways. Millions of album sales, 31 of her songs have hit top 40 charts around the world. She's an international artist in every sense of the word. As I mentioned, this is her 10th studio album. No two albums are alike in her catalog. We're going to dig into it in a second, but let's play a track from Fossara. Here is the title track from the new studio album from Bjork on Sound Opinions.
That is Fossara, the title track of Bjork's 10th studio album. The first we've heard from her, Greg, in terms of a full album since Utopia in 2017. There were a couple of EPs. I'm going to come across as surly today. I'm sorry. I'm Bjorked out. You know, when Bjork is just doing the operatic thing, and she has at various times characterized this album in many different ways. At one point, this was her bass clarinet album. I'm not so sure I needed a bass clarinet album with operatic Icelandic vocals. It's about her interest in mushrooms, in part, using mushrooms as a metaphor for finding hope in death, and about the matriarchy, a longtime subject of hers. Part of this, Greg, is about the death of Bjork's mom. She died in 2018, and then lockdown followed. It's another lockdown album, and Bjork is grieving, but also looking for a way to find new life, all of which sounds more interesting to talk about or read about than to listen to on Fossora. It's precious, it's arty, it lacks the pop song sensibility, skewed as it was, of, I'd say, the first four or five albums. You know, I think Bjork of late has been far more in art rock, progressive rock territory, and I like progressive art rock. I don't know why this album is not grabbing me. I don't expect to have her go back and remake Post. I admire that she's constantly moving forward, but this is a slog to listen to. I'm waiting for you to tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I'm surprised that you're so down on it, because I'm listening to this record and I go, Jim must love this record because it reminds me a lot of early Genesis. To my mind, you know, this would be right up your alley.
Yeah, so but
you're blowing my mind right now.
Genesis,
man,
had the hooks, man. They might have been delivered on a Mellotron in 9/17 time or something. I can't understand.
They're hooks here. I mean, it's an orchestral pop record. She's been, but you know, anybody who's expecting Bjork to repeat herself is going to be holding their breath for a very, very long time, waiting for that moment to occur. She doesn't do that. You know, she's constantly working with new people, refreshing her sound, refreshing the stuff that she loves. And this is another example of that. You know, just when you think she's going to zig, she zags. And this is an album with neoclassical suites, industrial soundscapes, I mean, hardcore techno beats. She's working with this Indonesian production team, bringing in some beats, choral hymns, as you mentioned. Motherhood's the big topic. I think that ties in, you know, motherhood, mother nature, you know,
yes,
the earth. We're making an earthier record.
Things die, and then mushrooms grow.
And as you mentioned, her mother's death is a major topic on this record. The fact that she is a mother is a major subject on this record as well. You know, she's now the matriarch in that family. Two of her children perform on this record. So that's a big theme throughout. I'll admit, like you, I love the first four or five, records that she made as a solo artist.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the beats were there. And I remember interviewing her in 97. I had to dig back for these for this quote. And she said, "This is why I wear big shoes, almost always clumsy shoes. The hippies wore soft shoes, and the punks wore massive shoes. I'm closer to that side. My beats are all smash, smash, smash." Adipose and the title song bringing in those big beats from the Indonesian production team. The way she uses the voices that as a sort of a staccato percussion device on that song, Mycelia. And then the beauty of the two songs where she's basically paying direct tribute to her late mom, Sorrowful Soil and Ancestress.
Into sorrowful soil, sorrowful soil, our roots are dark.
So I will acknowledge, I don't love this entire record, but the songs I just mentioned, that's peak Bjork, and I think, you know,
oh, I don't know.
Mycelia
to me sounds like Fantasia
spit
out by a kid obsessed with EDM.
That to me is like the Genesis moment, you know? I mean, Jim DeRogatis, you're disappointing me. Go back and listen to those Genesis records.
I listened to this 16 times and it wasn't doing it for me.
I'm lost and I'm lonely. I hunger for
taste for hell.
That is a little bit of the song Wolf by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs from Cool It Down, that group's first album, Greg, in forever. We haven't heard from them since 2013 with an album called Mosquito. Led by Karen O, as captivating a front person as we've seen in decades, really, in rock. Driven by two incredibly talented and inventive instrumentalists, guitarist Nick Zinner and drummer Brian Chase. They were a huge part, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, of that early 2000s Lower East Side, Williamsburg, Brooklyn, scene of hipsters bringing back the rock, the Strokes at the head of the class, but plenty of other good bands. We've seen a lot of nostalgia for that period, probably kicked off with the book Meet Me in the Bathroom. Mm. And now, after a long absence, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs are back. Karen O has been living in Los Angeles. Nick and Brian have said, we wait for Karen to decide when it's time. And now it's time, almost a decade on. What are the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, working with Dave Sitek, giving us on this album, Cool It Down? There's a hint in that title. They said, intentionally, they're evoking the Velvet Underground, one of their lesser-known but mm-hmm. way cool songs, Cool It Down. Let's play a track here and dig into our reviews. This is the opening track, Spitting Off the Edge of the World. Got a guest cameo from Perfume Genius, who's a big fan of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Here they are on Sound Opinions.
That is Spitting Off the Edge of the World from the new Yeah Yeah Yeahs album, Cool It Down, a very transparent cry of rage, frustration about the world coming to an end due to the climate crisis. And the kids cry out, as Karen O said.
The kids cry out, and then we hear from Karen's kid at the end of the album on a track called Mars.
Exactly. So the kids are crying out because the previous generations have failed them, you know, including Karen O. She's putting herself in the sights, too. Motherhood's a big topic today, Jim, because we talked about it with the Bjork album and now again
mothers,
with the Karen O record. She is a mom now. It's amazing how she's evolved. Do you remember the days when people used to wear raincoats to Yeah 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 shows? Because inevitably Karen would shower them with beer from the stage.
She was a wild performer. It was impossible to take your eyes off her. It was impossible not to get sucked into what that band was doing.
As a trio, they made a big sound, and the first few records were so vital and so exciting and magnified by the stage presence of Karen O. It's amazing how they've evolved. You listen to this record now, you really don't hear a ton of traces of that band that made that amazing record in 2003, you know, the Fever to Tell record, which is still, I think, one of the classics of that era, that New York City heyday era of the early 2000s.
And that single, Maps, was era-defining.
It absolutely was. This album is not going to be era-defining. I think it's a good record, but it's not a great one. They've evolved towards this moody dance pop instead of that trashy post-punk that they were doing early on, which is fine. I love to see bands evolve. I love to see where they're going. About half of this record works, and that's a problem, though, because we're talking about eight songs. It's a very slight record, given the fact that they've been away for almost 10 years, 9 years to be precise. That's it. That's all we got.
That's all you got.
And the last two songs on this record are pretty weak. I got to tell you, she's never been a great lyricist. I think the Different Today really wears thin after a while. There's basically two phrases that are repeated throughout that song, a very slight song, lyrically. Yeah. I feel different today, different today. How the world keeps spinning out of control.
How the world keeps on spinning, it goes spinning out of control. How the world keeps on spinning, it goes spinning out.
the tracks that resonate the most for me in terms of just the personal investment is, you know, obviously Mars about her son, that moment with her son. Spinning Off the Edge of the World is a great track. I think one of the best ones that they've ever made. And I loved Fleas because, you know, that shout out to ESG, it just got me. It's an up-tempo track, and it's got some of that spirit that they had early on.
Just for listeners' sake, that's F-L-E-E-Z,
right,
as opposed to the fleas you don't want to be infested with. And, you know, ESG drawing the line from 2000 New York hipsters to the post-punk 1980 era.
You know I won't do battle with no fiction. The wilderness becoming mine.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Jim, why the reunion? You know, you figure after 9 years they'd have a lot to say. There would be a little bit more here. It's a little bit underwhelming for me.
It is. Can I quote Cot at Cot?
Sure.
One of my favorite things that you've ever said, one of your pocket rules is, reunions are fine, whether we're talking Pixies, Mission to Burma, but only if the band is coming back to complete unfinished business. Mm. You know, I don't feel like there was unfinished business, not in terms, aside from the kind of ESG bringing in that arty dance pop, emphasizing it. Certainly Karen doesn't have a lot to say, and we've heard better, especially from Nick Zinner. I think he was one of the signature guitarists of that 2000 period, probably the virtuoso in terms of his abilities to stretch out. I remember you waxing rhapsodic.
Not a lot of guitar here.
No, not a lot of guitar. Where is he, you know? And, by the Cot unfinished business rule, they didn't have any and they don't deliver.
So very mixed reviews here on Bjork and the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs. We want to hear from you now. What are your opinions of these records? Two iconic bands slash artists coming back with new stuff.
That.
Yep. Share your thoughts in a voice message at our website at soundopinions.org, and we may play it on the show. Coming up, we're going to take a close look at Pearl Jam's long career with Stephen Hayden. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
And he hit me with a surprise
laugh. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. We're happy to welcome back friend of the show, Stephen Hayden, to discuss his new book on Pearl Jam, Long Road. You know, Mr. Cot, this interview put Steve in the upper echelons of guests we've had on this show. It's his fourth appearance, almost like the Five Timers Club on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I guess we owe him a jacket or something, right? Don't they give the jacket out to a five-timer?
I guess so. I wanted to be combative with him here because I don't worship Pearl Jam quite like Stephen does.
We're going to find out about that in a second here. But seriously, his new book, Long Road, is a great read, and it covers a really tumultuous time in the music industry and the unexpected choices Pearl Jam made at some critical junctures. I mean, the fact that that band is still going is kind of amazing. I mean, they've been able to sort of survive various changes in trends and their personal issues and still maintain a sort of cachet where they can sell out stadiums wherever they play. And Steve, in many ways, is the perfect person to write that story.
As a music critic, the thing I'm most fascinated by is the arc of careers, especially for bands, and studying the career arcs and comparing them and trying to figure out, like, why do some bands fall apart after 5 years and why do other bands continue on for decades? With Pearl Jam, I just feel like they have one of the most interesting careers for a superstar rock band, having just huge success in the first 5 years of their career. And really, I feel like people forget, like, how popular they were in, like, say, from 92 to 96. They were doing Taylor Swift numbers. I mean, they could sell a million records in a week, which for a band like that, like, just trying to wrap your head around it, it seems impossible 30 years later. And how they transitioned into this band now where they can still play arenas and stadiums, but they have virtually no mainstream media profile. You know, Eddie Vedder, you know, if you want to compare him to someone like Dave Grohl, for instance, you know, when there's a new Foo Fighters record, Dave Grohl is all over the place. You know, he's on talk shows.
Everywhere.
He's in documentaries. Yeah. Very visible guy. Eddie Vedder, for the most part, you know, has not participated in that in a long time. So they have this sort of underground thing going on, and yet they're this hugely popular mainstream rock band. So I just thought that was an interesting thing, and I thought, oh, I can write a book about that. That's what drew me in.
I was covering the band pretty closely, and I think you nail it in the book, where there was a breaking point or a turning point in 1995 where even people in Pearl Jam thought the band may not have many more days left.
Yeah. When you factor in how the bands around them ended up, it makes that story, I think, even more remarkable. I mean, the big four Seattle bands of the early 90s, you have, obviously, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, all multi-platinum bands. The frontmen of the other three bands have all passed away, and passed away in self-destructive fashion. You know, Pearl Jam, in many ways, had the most pressure on them at that time. But even like Nirvana, as big as they were not as big as Pearl Jam was at their peak. And they're a band that probably should have imploded, but didn't. And that was another thing, you know, that plays into the title of the book, you know, Long Road, this idea that they were able to continue and to endure all of these various things that happened both internally and externally. I just think it's a really interesting story to contemplate. And along with the fact, Greg, you alluded to this, I mean, this is a band that their first record came out a week and a half before my 15th birthday. So, like, I am square in the demographic for a band like this to be meaningful for the people, I guess, who read the book.
You know, Jim and I were both at that Lollapalooza early in the day. That was the second incarnation of Lollapalooza. It was 92, right? Where they were the second band on the stage in the broad daylight.
And Eddie Vedder was literally climbing the raft.
The response to that band that day was like, holy man, something is really happening here. It sort of went from, oh yeah, an interesting debut record. You know, I remember they played Metro, I think, in that February, and it was a good show, and Billy Corgan came on stage, and, you know, it was a bunch of pals from the alt-rock, you know, underground, right? And suddenly Pearl Jam went, and I think they, later that summer of 92, they were involved in three top 10 records. Their debut album was on the top 10. There was that side project that they did with Soundgarden when Eddie first came to, you know, the Andrew Wood tribute record, and the singles soundtrack.
He was ably backed by Stone and Jeff, and drummer Eddie Vedder. I mean, that's good. That's a good review.
A compliment for us is a compliment for you. No, man.
Was top 10. Mm-hmm. So they had three massive records.
Cameron Crowe, longtime fan, made that documentary about them. You don't tell the story, Stephen, in Long Road, despite being fascinated by the career arc of bands. You don't tell it chronologically. You kind of shuffle it up. As you said, your goal was to make like a mixtape with each chapter corresponding to a song, and that gives you the ability to then dive into different points in their career. What was the thought in this rather very 90s postmodern kind of construction of your book?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I'm a music critic. I'm not writing a biography, and I tried to make that up front at the beginning of the book, that this is a book delving into them in a first-person kind of way, where I'm writing about them as a critic. And I like to think that there hasn't been a whole lot of writing about Pearl Jam from like a songwriting perspective or from a live performance perspective. You know, there's been a lot of talk about, obviously, like the Ticketmaster controversy, their place in, you know, the so-called grunge movement, all of that stuff. But, you know, as a music critic, I was interested in diving into the records and also diving into bootlegs and looking at them as a concert act. So to me, it just seemed like a good way to differentiate it from a, you know, conventional biography. And also, you know, I want it to feel like a conversation. You know, at best, I hope that people who love the band, and even people who don't love the band, and I know, Jim, you do not love the band. I'm curious I was reading some of your old columns. You were reviewing Pearl Jam shows, and you were just shredding them. I was like, I mean, I'm a critic. I can enjoy a pan, you know, even if I like the thing that's being panned. Pretty funny. My hope is that it feels like you're having a conversation with someone on a road trip, and maybe this tape is playing.
With a fan, yeah. That you're reveling in fandom,
yeah,
together.
And you listen to this tape together, and you're sort of diving in, having like a deep conversation about this. I couldn't breathe, holding me down, hand on my face, kissing the ground.
Let's talk about Ticketmaster. I think it's one of the most important stories I've covered in my career as a journalist. It's always reported wrong. The Department of Justice went to Pearl Jam to offer evidence about Ticketmaster's egregious pricing. As I recall, there were two shows, Greg, if you remember, Chicago Regal Theater on the South Side and Stadium Show. I think it was the last show at the old Chicago Stadium before it was torn down to make way for United Center. And there was $1.50 charge added by Ticketmaster to the ticket, and Pearl Jam was furious. You write, Stephen, I think one of the most important paragraphs in the book, a common narrative about grunge is that the movement died when Kurt Cobain took his own life. There's a lot of truth to that. But the moment when it was clear beyond a shadow of a doubt that an era had ended was Pearl Jam's depressingly futile fight against Ticketmaster. Here was an example, the only example really, of an alt-rock band taking on the system in a very real and tangible way, and the campaign failed due entirely to a lack of any real conviction by the public to see the change through. You know, my reporting at the time was, I interviewed Gossard. He was angry because it was Ament and Vedder that went to war with Ticketmaster. I interviewed Ament. He was unapologetic about the fact that that band, at the height of its popularity and career, couldn't play effectively for 2 to 3 years because every venue in America was monopolistically controlled by Ticketmaster.
Right.
They were playing in cow pastures.
Right.
Right? When they could play at all. You know, Gossard and the rest of the band wanted to keep making money. And Vedder and Ament had a stand on principle. Eventually they caved because, and that paragraph I read it because it was the fans. The fans let them down. Instead of the fans going to war with them against Ticketmaster, the fans just kept griping, "How come I can't go see Pearl Jam?"
Right.
What kind of psychic damage? I mean, the next album was called Yield.
Yeah, well, not to mention that other bands didn't line up behind them to support the cause.
You
right?
had REM's manager and Aerosmith's manager testifying on Capitol Hill, but nobody put their money where their mouth is. Only Pearl Jam.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look back at the coverage at the time. It's funny that Gossard said that to you because he was one of the people that testified in front of Congress.
Yes,
it was Gossard and Ament that testified, not Eddie Vedder, which is interesting. That Eddie didn't go.
No, Vedder wanted to sit it out, yeah.
And I write about this in the book, that the popularity of alternative music at that time, I think, was really rooted in the idea that it was an anti-establishment type music. That you look at the title, alternative, it's built in there that we're presenting something that's not mainstream culture. At least that was the marketing of it. I mean, they literally put out a record called Versus. That's their second record, and there's lots of confrontational songs on there. And going against Ticketmaster, you know, was going beyond talking about being oppositional and actually taking a tangible step toward changing the music industry. And as you said, I can't think of another example of a band that is at the absolute peak of their commercial career where if they had just played ball, I mean, they would have made tens of millions of dollars touring at that time.
It was a courageous and principled stand, and their reward is Kurt Cobain's on the cover of Rolling Stone in a corporate magazine Still Suck t-shirt, taking a shot at Pearl Jam for being sellouts.
Right, but for added context, think about this. I mean, we're talking about like an $18.50 ticket.
Right?
Yeah.
They're saying, you know, we don't want anything over $1.50. We can't charge our fans any more than $20, right? In the same year, the Eagles go on tour, and they're charging over $100 per ticket, and they are getting it and selling out stadiums. So the whole industry was kind of at a crossroads, like, what's the tipping point here, right? Which way is it going to go? And Pearl Jam really did try to dig their heels in and say, Ticketmaster, you're a monopoly. They were exactly right.
Absolutely.
And ticket prices are getting out of control. They got in on it early, and Ticketmaster was like, no, we're not going to change anything. You guys have to play ball with us. And, you know, I talked to Vedder a few years after that, and I said, what did you learn from it? He said, well, a corporation kicked our ass is what I learned from it. And he says, you know, it just defeated them. You know, they tucked their tails between their legs and said, you know, okay, do you want to have a band anymore? And I think Eddie was dead set on ending the band if he needed to. But the other guys weren't going to go along with it.
Well, it defeated them because, you know, again, as Steven writes, and I couldn't agree with him more, people didn't follow them and support them.
Yeah, there wasn't like a big rally in the streets or anything
like
that.
Apathy.
Yeah.
Apathy.
Yeah, and the way the media talked about it at that time, you know, there was a famous Rolling Stone cover story about Eddie Vedder in 96. It was a write-around piece because he wasn't interviewed for it.
Yeah.
But it was basically a hatchet job against Eddie Vedder and accusing him of being a phony, that he wasn't really this angsty guy, that he was like a theater kid in high school and he was popular, and that this was all sort of a contrivance, his public image. And part of that story was talking to anonymous industry insiders about like what dopes Pearl Jam were for taking the stand against Ticketmaster, that, you know, that they that they sacrificed all this money and people just wanted to see them live. And that was, I think, a narrative at the time, that people just looked at this as like like they're Don Quixote or something. But it was only because people believed that the system couldn't change. You know, the system that was invented, like the system could have been changed if people felt motivated to do it. But it was just this ingrained idea that like, no, this is the way it is. And you're foolish to fight it. And of course, here we are. 25 some years later, and you know, you have stories about people being charged $5,000 to see Bruce Springsteen, you know, from Live Nation. It's just gotten way worse, you know.
They fought the fight when things could have been stopped, and now it's way too late.
Well, here's the thing, you know, and I think we were getting at this point here. You mentioned this whole idea that alternative meant they were going to address all these things that needed to be addressed, about whether the content of the songs, the fact that women were at the forefront of a lot of Pearl Jam songs, the idea that the voiceless were at the forefront of a lot of the songs, the lyrics that Vedder was writing.
She lies and says she's in no town, can't find a better man.
And they wanted to extend that sort of sense of the exploited having a voice in the matter, the exploited being people who they felt were being ripped off for, you know, exorbitant ticket prices. Mm-hmm. And they were the only band that really walked the walk.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just talking the talk. And they became instantly my favorite band. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of the music, but my God, I thought that had real balls. I mean, they were just like, you know, actually doing what they did. And it's kind of sad. Like, ever since they kind of got punched in the mouth and they sort of got up off the floor and said, okay, we're going to keep this going, it really hasn't been the same. I don't know, you felt, Stephen, that the remarkable story is that they picked themselves up and kept going. But at the same time, I always felt like, okay, in some ways they compromised and they've never been the same band since.
It's a very interesting point. I mean, you know, Jim alluded to this earlier, that once the Ticketmaster stuff, you know, finally was resolved, and then 98 they did a big arena tour that was a Ticketmaster tour that coincided with a record called Yield, which was their fifth record. And musically, it was a very accessible, catchy, radio-friendly record. But lyrically, it's, I think, really about exhaustion and defeat. And there's something prescient about that, because you look at the late 90s, and I think for the most part, the music we associate with that time is very up and happy and and maybe kind of silly and stupid. You know, like that was nu metal, that was teen pop, you know, like the country was flush with money, you know, it was the Clinton era. And here's Pearl Jam putting out, which is on one hand a very catchy record, but is also, I think, lyrically a record about the end of idealism in a lot of ways.
What are you running from? Taking pills to get along, creating walls to call your own.
And it's interesting because for a lot of people, that is where they end with Pearl Jam. That's the moment, I think, where a lot of people left. And then there's this other period that is more about like hardcore fans really latching onto them, and them and Pearl Jam almost becoming like a big time cult band. The way I look at it is that, you know, starting with that 2000 tour that was famously documented where they put out 72 bootlegs of the tour. It was funny at the time, but that was another prescient move because there's a lot of bands now that put up all their concerts on Nugs.net to stream. You know, Pearl Jam is one of those bands. You couldn't do that in 2000. You just had to put them all out on CD. I think the idea that they could change things ended with the Ticketmaster thing. But then, you know, they settled into a career where it was about being a great live band. You know, and I really think at that point that became the focus, even more than records.
My template was, I called them the Grateful Dead for Gen X, right? And Grateful Dead, like people say, oh, they suck. You know, well, I got to say, my favorite Grateful Dead music is on the bootlegs, the Dick's Picks,
right,
from the early 70s, even into the late 80s. They had great shows. And you're right, Pearl Jam's shows have been better than the records, in part because they mix it up, but they're still overly reliant on the first album in particular, 10, which I guess they're obligated to play, right? You know, the Grateful Dead would never pack a concert full of songs from their most popular records, which would have been like Working Man's Dead or American Beauty.
No,
right?
It's like the Stones got to play Satisfaction. Pearl Jam's got to play Jeremy Spoke.
I will say, though, that like, oh my God, if you look at their career and, you know, when tours are corresponding with albums, they do play like a big part of the album. What started happening later in their career is that they discovered, well, we can tour without an album. You know, and that started happening into the aughts and then 2010s, where the albums really become few and far between later on. I do think that they've done a good job throughout their career weaving in new material. But yeah, it goes without saying that there's like 5 songs from 10 that they have to play at every show. And they usually come towards the end of the set. In the encore, you know, you're going to have Alive, you're going to have Jeremy, you're going to have Black, you're going to have Yellow Ledbetter, which isn't on 10, but it's a B-side from that era. Again, I think more than most bands on that level, they do shake it up more. You know, I think that they operate more like a jam band, even though they're not a jam band.
Have you seen Pearl Jam live? Would you call them a jam band now? I mean, I don't know. Some people would.
I would.
Share your thoughts at our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play them on the show. Coming up, Jim will let us all know how he really feels about the band, and we're going to hear Stephen Hayden's response. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. We're talking with Stephen Hyden about his new book on Pearl Jam, and we're about to get into the spicy part of the interview.
All right. Well, Stephen, you know we love you and respect you on Sound Opinions, but you made reference to this earlier. You and I were going to tussle.
Yes.
You know, we believe everyone is a critic. I have been bored to freaking tears by Pearl Jam's recordings. If I'm in a good mood, I'll say since Yield. But if I'm really being truthful, I would say since Vitalogy, album number 3. And I don't buy this great live band thing, right? Because I've seen Pearl Jam like a dozen times from the beginning through not long ago. You know, when Eddie would climb the rafters on stage, right, and put his physical being on the line, it was galvanizing, it was gripping, it was you couldn't take your eyes off him. I've seen him be more interesting solo on ukulele than Pearl Jam has been. I know he's older, right? He's my age, right? You know, it's like, and to that I would respond with two words: Iggy Pop. All right? Yeah. Iggy is still 110% physically on the line. Vedder puts on the guitar like Jagger does, just so, you know, he can, you know, not have to run around and be... I mean, he's boring. It's boring on stage. Why am I wrong to write off, you know, most of the 11 albums, except for the first three? Why am I wrong to say I never need to see Pearl Jam live again?
Well, okay, so... You can't argue someone out of their taste, so I'm not going to be able to persuade you necessarily that they're a great band. What I would
Brother, we've done almost 900 episodes of Sound Opinions. That's the whole point of the show.
Well, what I'm going to say, though, is this isn't with the intent of, like, trying to convert you, you know, to my religion. It's more to put the opposing perspective out there for your listeners.
That's what we want, yes.
So you're certainly right. Like, early in Pearl Jam's career, Eddie Vedder was a much more physical performer. You talk about how he used to climb the rafters. You know, he would climb up to the theater boxes if they were in a theater. Sometimes, you know, in a genuinely dangerous fashion. And that coincided with a younger period in their career where the music was very, almost operatic, you know, certainly bombastic, you know, and those kind of gestures, I think, fit with that era of the band. I think starting, like I said, with that 2000 tour, there was an evolution, and this is around the time where Eddie Vedder started to play more guitar, where those theatrics aren't as much of a part of the show, but I would argue that the band actually became much more nuanced at that time, that it wasn't all about the big gesture, it wasn't all about, like, jumping up and down and going crazy on stage, which, with the exception of Iggy Pop, I don't think you can sustain for your entire career. I mean, Iggy Pop is a singular figure for so many reasons. He can get away with that. But I think if you're in your 40s, it starts to look a little ridiculous if you are acting like you're still 25.
Well, I think there's variations on it. I mean, when Peter Gabriel would sing Lay Your Hands on Me and spread out cross-like and have the audience pass him over their heads from the stage to the last row. I mean, he was 40 at that point.
Yeah, but he's not wearing, like, the flower pot on his head, you know?
I guess what I'm saying is I always wanted to see Pearl Jam evolve into something
different,
but as exciting as the first three albums, as exciting as the first 5 years of live performance. Instead, they became classic rock. You write a lot about The Who. And the influence that The Who had on Eddie.
Yeah.
They wanted to be The Who.
Right. Yeah. And I would bring up The Who And also Bruce Springsteen as examples of other people that I think are more exciting on stage than on their records. Like, even the greatest Who records can't touch Live at Leeds or any live bootleg.
You know, or Crazy Horse, you know, a band that Pearl Jam played with Neil Young.
Right. Even with the best Pearl Jam records, like the classic albums that you're referring to, I think even if you listen to bootlegs from that period, they're a different band on stage than they are on record. You know, to piggyback on Greg's point, I always feel like they were a classic rock band. I mean, they were playing with Neil Young on the MTV Video Music Awards, you know, a few years into their recording career. I mean, that's, again, just imagine that now, like a young rock band playing like with someone like that, like on the MTV Video Music Awards. I mean, they were already, I think, looking to place themselves in that lineage, when that lineage still, I think, had commercial power. Because even a few years after Pearl Jam's peak, that's when you start getting the rise of new metal bands, like a band like Korn, for instance, which is a very deliberate break from classic rock history. You know, that's the beginning of something new. And people can argue about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it was certainly new. And it wasn't as connected to 60s and 70s music as Pearl Jam was. You know, and that was always like a criticism of Pearl Jam. I still feel this way. I think that they have punk rock ethics, but to me, they're not like a convincing punk rock band. Like when they would play punky type songs like Spin the Black Circle, like that's not my favorite mode of them. I mean, I know Amit and Gossard in particular have roots in like 80s DIY music that are real and deep, but they just slot in my mind better like with The Who and Bruce Springsteen and these, again, these like sort of operatic, big sounding arena rock bands.
And I know what Jim's saying. There have been some shows that I've seen of Pearl Jam that felt kind of rote, not exactly phoning it in, but certainly kind of dull. But that, you know, I do remember seeing, like, for example, a show at Wrigley Field where there was a big crowd, a lot of anticipation, and they opened, like, you're expecting them to open explosively. They opened with Release, you know, this song that's kind of moody and builds over a long period of time, and it was like this stunning moment where they, okay, we're going to create something here, you know, in the moment, and it felt really cool the way they did it. And then I think you mentioned this in the book too, Stephen, Yellow Ledbetter, one of those songs where they performed it at that one show in Philly in 2016 where they performed 10, one of the very few times front to back, and they closed with that. And it's just an amazing moment. You know, you kind of like, oh, wow, they're pulling this thing out that wasn't even released on the official record. Just a beautiful version of that song. They're capable of doing stuff like that that I think is really kind of moving. They've been able to sustain it for a long time. And that audience has stayed with them in part because I think a lot of the bands that were so revered from that era, whether it's Soundgarden or Nirvana or, you know, Smashing Pumpkins or Nine Inch Nails, those bands have sort of come and gone in a lot of ways. They've either dissolved or kind of quit and started again. Pearl Jam somehow has hung in there, you know, for the long haul, which is rare for any band. I mean, basically, it's the four key guys plus a drummer, right? The drummer has been the only change in that band since the beginning, right?
Five drummers at this point, Stephen?
Yeah. There was, and you know, Cameron has been there since 98. So, I mean, there's a long tenure with him, although in my mind, I still think of him as Soundgarden's drummer. Like, for their audience right now, that has stuck with them, I think the live show is the key to what has kept them going. There is an element, I think, with Pearl Jam where even if Eddie Vedder isn't climbing rafters anymore, that isn't easy music to play if you're in your 50s. I mean, there still is, I think, a pretty strong physicality to at least how Pearl Jam sounds live. And I think for the audience, there's something kind of special about that because, you know, when you have these legacy bands, I think the reason why people stay connected is that there's so few things that still exist from the time you were a teenager. Most of the friends that you have from that time, you don't stay in touch with. But this is one thing that has hung around, and it's a way, I think, to reconnect with a part of yourself when you go to a show like that.
You know, I'm in the middle of fall semester. I have got 300 18-year-old students who love music in my classes. All right? I want you to play Desert Island Jukebox Pick. You know we love you. We don't share the wealth doing that often. Give us a song to convince my young student who loves guitar and rock, you know, that Pearl Jam matters to them. And it's got to be from the last 10 years. I don't care if it's a bootleg track or whatever, but show them that it is not just what you just said, nostalgia, right? I mean, I think fondly of those Lollapalooza performances. I think fondly of that Chicago Stadium performance. Yeah, I'll never forget, Greg. You remember this? When Eddie said, there was a contest, right, by the local alt-rock station that tapped his mom, who had been a psychiatrist, to read the copy and give away tickets. And this greatly offended Eddie because he had problems with mom and dad, all right? But and he said, you know, people don't believe that I lived here or that I grew up here in Evanston. And then he sang this carpet jingle, which 35 years later is still every third commercial you see on, like, local TV. You know, he covered a carpet jingle, right? Anyway. I got my nostalgia, you got yours. My 18-year-old 300 students, they don't know nothing about it. Give them something. Right. I've been rambling to give you time to make the perfect
choice. Yeah, well, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm not going to say a song. I'm going to say an entire concert bootleg. And I'm going to say...
No, that's fine.
I'm going to say the bootleg of their show at Wrigley Field in 2013. Because
that's the one I was talking
about. Yeah, exactly.
That's a great show.
It's a great show. There's a long rain delay at that show. And the argument I would make, and I'm going to push back against the nostalgia thing here, because I think the thing about live performance, even if you are playing older songs, is that songs get reinvented if it's a really great band. And, like, I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan, and he can play Visions of Johanna 100 different ways. And I feel like my enjoyment of the newest version isn't because I liked it 20 years ago. It's being reinvented in real time, and I'm appreciating what it is now.
Yeah, although so many, you know, fans even, I couldn't even recognize what he was playing. Right, well, you know he gets that quite
exactly,
a bit.
But those are the dumb people, and we're not going to worry about the dumb people. but to me, that show, it's such an example of Pearl Jam playing on, like, the biggest stage and making it feel spontaneous and real when so many shows like that feel sterile and phoned in, and they're doing the same set list in every city. You got the lighting cues dialed in. And that's why a lot of people don't like those kinds of shows, because they don't feel alive in the way that a smaller show would. So I would say, listen to this show. I think there's so many great, just spontaneous moments in that show and examples of them connecting with people in a very real way that, and this is a cliche, but I think it's true, it makes Wrigley feel like a club. Like, you feel that space being shrunk down. And I think that's a magic trick, and there's very few bands that can do that, and I think Pearl Jam is one of them. So I'd say the July 19th, 2013 bootleg, I would slip them that. And I'd say, like, this might not sound great, but the graininess is part of it. I think you'll enjoy it. Give it a shot.
Appreciate that passion.
Yeah, that was a great show. I'm in agreement with Stephen on that one. That was a revelation too. Well, thank you, Stephen Hyden. You were always a font of knowledge and insight, and thanks for battling with us. It's always fun to talk.
Long Road, Pearl Jam, and the Soundtrack of a Generation. Stephen's fifth music book.
Yes, thank you guys. It's always a pleasure talking with you. You're both heroes of mine, so I appreciate you guys checking it out and being kind enough to let me on.
It's always great to have Stephen Hyden on the show, even when I disagree with him. And, you know, to have him back multiple times. He ranks up there for us with Nico Case or Amy Mann, John Worster. But I don't know if he counts, because he comes playing with different bands every time, you know? I like your idea of the jacket, though.
Yeah, well, you know, I like jackets. What can I tell you? It's the fall. I'm wearing a jacket right now, Jim.
Maybe
I can give him my jacket. How's that sound?
That'll be all right. Well, what do we have on the show next week?
Well, we're going to talk about another jam, Jimmy Jam. We've got a long interview with Jimmy that we're going to give you in full next week. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast where we add new songs to the Desert Island Jukebox.
Absolutely. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.